How come everything's so fucked up? Alright, peoples. We're back. That was enough of that. That was another test of the noise. The noise. We'll just call it the noise. Alright, previous episode ended in a really good spot, so this is going to be part two. There's going to be a part three, at least. We'll see how this goes. Previous episode ended in a really good spot because we got 4 pages worth of material to cover here. We are on page 143 for those of you reading along in the book. Just in case you're not paying attention, you'd read the show notes, look at the title, whatever. We're reading the book Loser Think, How Untrained Brains Are Ruining America by Scott Adams. Page 143, Word Thinking. Now this falls into the category of what I have two things I like to talk about. Number one, if you're going to do philosophy, you have to define your terms. But then on the other hand, we have this sort of inverse bastardized version of that, which is where people try to argue by definition, right? They define a word and then they think that defining the word is some kind of evidence for the thesis that they're putting forth. So to communicate accurately, we do have to define the words we're using. But simply defining your word that you're using as you're using it isn't evidence that your thesis is correct. So let's see what Scott Adams has to say on a very related topic. Word thinking. When you criticize something that has gone wrong, as all of us sometimes do, you might have a perfectly valid point, especially if you are using facts and logic. But if you find yourself re-engineering the meaning of common words to make your case, you might be engaging in what I call word thinking, a common form of loser think. Word thinking involves trying to understand the world or trying to win a debate by concentrating on the definition of words. Where have you heard this before? What do I say? Sometimes I wonder, does Scott Adams listen to my podcast? Because I've been talking about this for how long? Example, Pro-lifer, abortion is murder. Pro-choicer, otherwise known as pro-baby killer. See how we use words? Pro-baby killer, it's only murder when it's illegal, and it isn't illegal. Kind of like how, you know, doing medical experiments on Jews was not illegal in Nazi Germany. Kind of like how putting Japanese people in concentration under a Democrat president, FDR, was not illegal. Kind of like how the Tuskegee experiment, where we let a bunch of black men die from syphilis, was not illegal. You know, I always say, if you're making your arguments about what's right and what's wrong, morally right and wrong, based on what's legal and illegal, not only do you not have a moral compass, but you should be exterminated for the good of the human species. Because you are either truly evil or truly so stupid that your existence can be nothing but detrimental to the gene pool and the future of the species. Pro-lifer, call it what you will, but killing an innocent human life is immoral. Pro-choicer, a fetus isn't life until it can live on its own. Pro-lifer, life begins at conception, and so on. You can see this example. Whoops, let me start that sentence over. You can see in this example that no real debate is happening at all. It is little more than a debate about the definition of words. Now, here's the thing. Yes and no. If you're going to say, for example, if you are going to say abortion is murder, you do have to define what is murder. You have to define your terms. Okay, now, defining the term murder, and this is the distinction that I want to make. Defining the term doesn't necessarily mean you're right, but you do have to define what do you mean by murder. And then you go, oh, great one, everybody knows what murder means. Well, no, they don't, because if everybody knew what the word murder means and everybody had a common definition for the word murder, there would be no debate over whether or not abortion is murder. So you do have to define your terms in order to have a debate, right? And abortion is one where this is clearer than anything else. You do have to define what is and what is not human. What is not murder. Now, simply defining those words doesn't mean you've won the debate. Because you have to define them in a way, and then you have to get other people to agree with your definition. And then, okay, just because you've defined murder, you still have to do some level of rational thinking to then support the thesis that abortion is murder according to your definition of murder, right? So defining the terms is important. That's part of philosophy. But simply defining the term doesn't mean you've won or that you've proven anything or that your opponent is wrong, right? And that's what I call argument by definition. Where did we leave off? Here we go. The real debate involves finding a political balance between one side's preferred sense of morality and the other side's preference for allowing women to choose their best personal health, lifestyle, and economic outcomes. I mean, is that the gayest fucking definition you've ever heard of baby killers in your life or what? How about we said let's say there was a fake pandemic hoax. Let's call it the Wuhan hoax. Well, this is like a theoretical example. Let's say there's a Wuhan hoax And there were some people who wanted everyone to wear a muzzle on their face, because if you put magic cloth over your face, it's like the Mormon magic underwear, protects them from sinning or whatever it does. That magic cloth on your face will protect you from viruses. So are we going to look for a balance between one side's preferred sense of magic protection from viruses and the other side's preference for allowing people the freedom to choose their best personal health, lifestyle, and economic outcomes? Or are we just going to shut down a bunch of businesses and tell everybody they have to stay at home? All right. If you make an honest argument, either for or against abortion, you end up looking like a monster, albeit a different kind of monster, depending on which side you take. So most people quite reasonably retreat to the safest space on the topic, which is to insist their personal definition of words should determine national laws. He's not wrong about that. That's exactly what people do. People think that national laws should be based on their personal definitions of words. Rarely, if ever, does anyone use word thinking when the facts and logic are on their side and they feel safe to discuss them. Which then we should ask ourselves, why and how have we come to live in a society where people don't feel safe discussing things? Oh yeah, that's right, because if you discuss something that is not favorable with the powers that be, you could be ostracized, lose your job, and quite possibly even assaulted, and maybe even killed. We generally like the lead with our strongest arguments, and that means you leave the word thinking as your last resort. In fact, that's one of the ways I know how I have won a debate on Twitter. When the word thinking comes out, I declare victory and walk away. Let's look at some examples of word thinking. That was an example of me getting a drink of water. Normalizing. In political discussions, you often hear people saying that it would be bad to normalize one sort of behavior or another. The implication is that the behavior in question is both abnormal and undesirable. But normalize is a vague and subjective standard. What is the difference between normalizing something and simply doing something you think makes sense? How long does a new thing have to last before we call it normalized? Okay, so let's define normalized. Normalized means to normalize. You can't define things with themselves. To normalize something means to make it publicly, socially, economically, philosophically, legally acceptable. So, right now, the media and the GLBTKKK plus stands for pedophile, are working very hard to normalize pedophilia, to make 40-year-old men having sex with 8-year-old boys socially, economically, politically, morally, philosophically, and legally acceptable. That is what it means to normalize something. There are some cases where saying that somebody is trying to normalize something actually does mean something. Now, again, this is a word which typically, right, and again, I give Scott Adams credit here, because the next word he's going to delve into is problematic. So he goes after, you know, the right wingers. They love where they're normalizing. Pedophiles are going to normalize pedophilia. I mean, which they are. They are doing that. But you typing that on Twitter over and over all day long because you don't have anything productive to do with your life isn't going to stop the faggots from having sex with your children. Okay. And then problematic is, of course, the favorite buzz phrase of the leftist, because I am problematic because I'm white and heterosexual and I'm calling out the pedophiles for being pedophiles, right? I am problematic because I think pox and white people should live separately from each other and have their own distinct nations. Anyhow, let's get back to normalizing. We will never agree on what normalizing means. Well, I just defined the word. And that's the thing. Okay, sure. So somebody may hear the definition of the word normalizing that I just gave, and they may not agree with how I just defined normalizing. And I get that, and I don't fault that. Here's the thing. When you're using a word, as long as you use it consistently, like if I'm having a philosophical debate with you, okay? Once again, we can go back to abortion. You got murder. Is it murder? Is it a human life? Okay, I'm going to tell you, look, define for me what is and is not a human. If you give me a definition of what is and is not a human, and you use that definition consistently throughout your argument, now I can have a different definition of human than you, but as long as you have a definition and you use it consistently, I can't fault you for that. I can't fault the person I'm debating with for having a different definition of the term than I do. Because that's just part of disagreeing. If you, once again, normalize, whatever the fucking word is, normalize, pedophile, leftist, commie, anarcho-capitalist, whatever fucking word you've got, if you come up with a definition of the word that makes sense, and making sense isn't the same as I agree with it or you agree with it, okay? Makes your definition makes sense, that means it's internally consistent with itself, and then your definition is externally consistent with the rest of your worldview, okay? If you define your term and then you use that term consistently, then that's all anyone can ask for. So when Scott says, we will never agree on what normalizing means, okay, we don't need to all agree on what the fucking word means. We just need the people who use it to use it with consistency, right? For example, when I call people cucks, well, I could be accused possibly of word think or some shit. No, no, cuck has a very distinct meaning. A cuck is a person, use the term person loosely, a person who puts the long-term and short-term financial and genetic welfare of a person from a different race above and beyond the financial and genetic welfare of people within their own race. I made that up on the spot, so I could nitpick my own definition there to solid it down a little bit, but I'm trying to give you a decent example. So when I call somebody a cuck, I'm using that word in a very fucking specific way. I mean, it is a fun word to say, don't get me wrong, I like saying cuck. I like calling people cuck, it's funny. I mean, it's also not funny because they're cucks and they're destroying their own race for the benefit of another race. But the word has a meaning to me, and I use it consistently when I am expressing my worldview. So anyhow, let's get back to Scott Adams. We will never agree on what normalizing means, or even if it's a bad thing or a good thing in any particular situation. For example, you wouldn't want to normalize a sitting president criticizing the legitimacy of the press because press freedom is a core value. Ha ha ha. But that's making you think past the sale. The first question that must be answered is not whether or not. Let me start over. I'm confused. The first question that must be answered is whether or not the press has crossed a line from legitimate reporting to what some would call fake news that is pushing political agendas on both the left and the right. If that line has been crossed, it seems to me entirely legitimate, as well as productive, for leaders to point it out. On the other hand, if the line has not been crossed, we wouldn't want to make it a habit to act as if it had. The word normalize in this context influences you to uncritically accept that the press is beyond criticism. That is an example of word thinking in which the word normalize is used as a substitute for reasons. Words are not reasons by themselves, but they can feel like it. And I completely agree with that statement because that goes back to what I said about when people try to argue or debate. And again, remember, guys, I'm using argue not as yelling at your girlfriend arguing, forming an argument, right? A debate, that kind of argument. Defining words is not an argument. Words are not reasons by themselves. He is completely correct about that. When people have good arguments, they will more often than not gleefully show their work to anyone who will listen. I've been doing that for 15 years. You're welcome. Go fuck yourself. But when people have no compelling arguments for their points of view, they sometimes prefer to jump ahead to the, quote, don't normalize that behavior, unquote, stage and act like the argument makes itself. Right. So again, I agree with him that you can use the normalize. You can use the word normalize as an argument in certain situations. This can certainly be done, and you shouldn't do it. So you simply need to be aware of what the hell is coming out of your mouth. All right. If your only complaint about another person's behavior is that it might normalize something, you might not have any reasons to back your opinion. Once again, so my argument about pedophiles normalizing pedophilia, right? My complaint isn't simply that they're normalizing something. My complaint is that they're normalizing sex with 8-year-old children. So yes, I agree. If you're only arguing, well, you can't do that because you're going to normalize it. Well, simply normalizing something, whatever X, Y, or Z, simply normalizing X isn't really a value statement. You have to examine X and come up with reasons why normalizing X would be a good thing or a bad thing or a neutral thing. And now you're delving into specific circumstances and future projections and all this other stuff. Problematic. If you don't like someone's plan, but you don't have specific objections, you might be tempted to label the plan problematic. That generic label excuses you from having to provide facts and reasons to back up your opinion. Best of all, the word problematic sounds smart, which gives you unearned credibility. If you tried to describe what you meant by problematic, you might sound like this. Quote, well, I don't see any specific problems with your plan, but I feel as if there must be some. Unquote. You would be ignored or mocked for having such an empty opinion. But if you say the plan is problematic, you have suggested that there is some sort of common sense reason to expect problems, and geniuses such as yourself can recognize those problems. He's kind of hitting it out of the park right here. I mean, bam, home run. To be clear, you might be absolutely right about the risk of unspecified future problems. Some plans are so bad that it would take all day to list the ways they can go wrong. Those situations are indeed problematic. But in those cases, you can probably describe realistic scenarios for how things might go wrong. If the best you can do is label something problematic without offering some reasonable sounding speculation on exactly how that might be the case, you are engaging in loser think. As I said, people who have logic and facts on their side tend to show their work. People who don't have good arguments try to get away with labeling the situation as if the unstated argument were simply obvious. Consider the topic of freedom of speech. No matter how much you like the right to free speech, you have to agree it can cause some problems. But you can easily list examples of potential problems. For example, you might say bad people will spread damaging ideas. You might say people will lie in public and ruin the reputation of honorable people. If you can point out some reasonable potential problems, it is fair to summarize all of that as problematic. But if you find yourself calling a plan problematic and you can't give some reasonable sounding examples to back it up, that is loser think. All right. We got through that. We are bouncing to page 159. Here's another example of where I wonder if Scott Adams is smart enough to listen to my podcast. It's in a section called Coward. If you're calling someone a coward, you probably aren't saying anything useful. We all weigh the cost and benefits of decisions before acting, and fear is one of those variables. After almost any terrorist attack or mass shooting, you will see politicians and pundits proclaim the perpetrators were cowards. This is ridiculous. People who sacrifice their lives for causes, including evil causes, are the opposite of cowards. If they were cowards, they wouldn't do what they did. Anyone remember when the Great One pointed out that, you can call the people who flew those airplanes on 9/11 into those towers, you can call them a lot of things. Zealots, insane, religious, misled. But one thing you cannot call them is cowards. And the media was filled with people calling them cowards. We're on page 160. How much of this am I reading? All of it. How am I? Oh, great. I'm doing good on time because after this, we are going fucking long and hard like I did your girlfriend last night. Apologist. If you and I agree on a particular issue, you are likely to call me a genius for being on the same side as you, as your nearly divine wisdom. But if we happen to disagree, you might be tempted to label me an apologist for whatever badness you imagine I support. No progress can be made when labels substitute for reason. When your critics have strong arguments, they gleefully offer them. But when those critics have weak arguments, they often try to slap a label on you and hope no one notices the missing reasons. It's a common loser think strategy. Apologist isn't the only word used to sidestep debate. You also see labels such as narcissist, fascist, globalist, racist, and socialist. If your intention is to avoid real debate, hurling dismissive labels at your nemesis works great. One has no social obligation to debate with a nemesis that has been labeled into filthy irrelevance. But avoiding debates doesn't move anything forward, it doesn't persuade, and it doesn't make the world a better place. And of course, right now we're going through the phase where everybody is a racist and a white supremacist. Now, it's again, I think if you define your terms, okay, if you've got a definition of racist and you call someone a racist and you say you're a racist because my definition of racist is X, Y, and Z, and this person exhibited X here and Y there and Z there. Okay, I mean, again, this thing, you can't use labels. No, you can use labels. You absolutely can fucking use labels. You just have to use them accurately. You have to use them with intention. Well, intention is the wrong word. Hang on. I'm moving the table closer, so I have to stay. Hey, If you move the table with the water bottle on it closer to the fucking microphone, you don't have to walk away from the microphone to get a drink of water. Oh, what a concept. It's like I'm a genius. You would never know that I've been podcasting for 15 years. Just now figuring out these basic concepts. All right. Anyhow, yes, just call everyone a racist and you're done. You don't have to actually argue. All right, here we go. Let's see how this goes. Page 163, the Golden Age Filter. So, Scott Adams is very optimistic. Let me read his intro here. If you pay attention to the news, you are assaulted with one dire warning after another about how the world is barreling mindlessly towards doom. And that's why you shouldn't watch the news. Turn off the fucking news. It's easy to lose sight of the big picture. The world is doing well by historical standards, and the rate of improvement is increasing. In this chapter, I'll give you a quick tour of what is already going right and likely to continue going right. I do this to help you recognize how often you can be in a mental prison of negativity while things are actually going quite well. I'm an optimist by nature, and I confess to putting that bias on this chapter. But you don't need to buy into all my optimism to see the larger point that you have been sold a negative view of the future because of the business model of the press. You guys heard any of this before? If the press had a choice of scaring you or telling you everything is fine, one of those paths is more profitable. Fear sells, and I hope this chapter helps you keep the fear stories in context. Now, in general, I agree with Scott that things are getting better, but I think there are some areas where they're not going to get better in the foreseeable future. Now, there's going to be another part in this series because I'm not finished with the book yet. I also need to back up and talk about some stuff that's prior to page 115 because I didn't start taking notes until page 115. Anyway, there's going to be more. Earlier in the book, he talks about the slippery slope. And he makes an interesting point about arguing for the slippery slope. Let me see if I can summarize this as accurately as possible. When people come forth and they say, well, there's a slippery slope, like there's a slippery slope on gun control. So if we get this gun control law, there's going to be more. And it's kind of like the, what did he call it? Look at my notes here. Straight line predictions. Right? Slippery slope is kind of like a straight line prediction. In fact, as I stand here and think about it, I'm fucking going off road right now. I mean, it really is a straight line prediction. When someone makes a slippery slope argument, there's a gun control law, and there's going to be another gun control law, and the gun control laws will keep happening, and they will keep being more restrictive, and slippery slope, straight line prediction, very similar things. Now, Scott makes the point that what people who, you know, throw out the slippery slope argument do not account for is opposition. And so, for example, with gun control, well, you do have opposition to gun control. You have the NRA, you have the gun manufacturers, you have gun owners who will do things or vote for people or buy stuff or do things. You have sheriffs who will or will not enforce gun control laws, right? So there are things that are opposing the straight line projection, the slippery slope of gun control. Now, this is assuming that there actually is an opposition. And that's sort of where I fault him on that argument when he makes it, is because there are some things that are slippery sloping for which there is no opposition. Yeah, global warming. I mean, there's no opposition to global warming wackoism. Pedophilia. There's no opposition to the GLBT KKK plus, the plus stands for pedophilia movement. Right? I mean, if you simply even refuse to cook a fucking cake for homosexuals, the government will come and take money away from you and force you to do it. And if you still don't do it, you will get put into a cage. Right? So there's no opposition to the slippery slope of legalizing adults having sex with small children. So I see Scott's point, and his point is right, but his point hinges upon this opposition to the slippery slope existing. mean wearing muzzles. Here in Colorado, you've got to wear a muzzle if you go inside of the grocery store. There's a small number of people. No, there's actually just me. I'm the only one who's doing it. There's no opposition to the slippery slope of the muzzle becoming a required thing inside a building in the state of Colorado for probably the rest of the existence of the state of Colorado. There is no opposition. All right, so these are things he's optimistic about. And I'm going to be winging this a little because I'm going to read and then go crazy and then read and go crazy. We'll just see how this goes because I got notes here. Okay, education. Traditional education involves one instructor, blah, 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 expensive model. Online learning is rapidly growing and already cost-effective, but it's primitive. Eventually, the inevitable, you'll see Hollywood film model for online educators. The teacher might be a good presenter, like an actor. The course content will be CGI and stuff like that. Then add the ability to measure who gets clicks and the highest test grades, blah, blah, blah. At the moment, online learning is inferior to a physical classroom experience for most subjects. But that gap will shrink rapidly, and eventually, the online experience will be far superior, more widely available, and much less expensive than college. Someday, we might see public schools replaced by online courses and augmented by social get-togethers for students. Allow me, Mr. Adams, and my God, I love your optimism. I really do. Let me explain to you why you're wrong. Because you see, Mr. Adams, the great one himself, the founder of the Cynical Libertarian Society, has been on the internet since 1999, podcasting for 15 years, who is right, who is always right, who has always been right, who has never been wrong. And you can prove that to yourself by purchasing the CLS archive that has every episode of the podcast and a shit ton of extra stuff. It's got movies, it's got videos, it's got stuff that's been banned off of YouTube, including a shit ton of Stefan Molyneux's videos and American Renaissance. It's got fucking Japanese anime on it. It's got Armor Hunter Mellow Link, which is fucking awesome. You can buy all of that, and you can listen to the Great One, and you too can hear the Great One back when he was young and stupid saying the same stupid shit. Because by golly, I too thought that K through 12, and let's break this up, K through 12 and college, let's take these separately. I too thought that K through 12 college was going to be replaced by computers. See, here's what I thought was going to happen. By the way, I was wrong. Here's what I envisioned. And I don't know how long ago I envisioned this. You'd have to listen to the podcast and figure it out. You know what? If you ever listen to past archives and you hear like an episode where I say this, guys, seriously, send me a message and tell me because I would love to know. I said what was going to happen was that we would get to a point where only kids from wealthy families would have real life teachers. They would be, because their parents would be able to afford them. Okay, let's slow the fuck down. So the mouth, catch up with the brain, Great One. It would be parents who were rich enough to either send their children to public school, and God damn it, send their children to private schools or to hire tutors. Those would be the children who would have human teachers. I predicted, wrongly, that public schools, you know, the schools where the common kids go, would turn into a place where the kids would sit at computer terminals all day and interact with the computer, and there would basically be somebody there to monitor behavior, and there would be somebody there to fix the computers, but there would be nothing that resembles a teacher. Now, see, that is a straight line prediction. Looking at technology, that was, I was making sort of a straight line, slippery slope prediction. What I did not factor in, and what Scott Adams is not factoring in, is that which is in opposition to the straight line prediction. And we all know what the opposition to this is. It's called the teachers' union. K through 12 will never go away, not in our lifetimes, not in the lifetime of anyone who listens to this podcast, because the teachers' union. Even now, with the Wuhan hoax and people at home, the teachers are shitting themselves. We've got to get the kids back in school. If the kids don't have teachers, they're going to fall. And even with the online thing, you've heard this. I know you've heard this if you've paid any attention to the internet. There's people running around going, well, but online learning is unfair because some students don't have high-speed internet and it's discriminatory. Right? There is no fucking way in hell the K through 12 system is going to shift to an online computer-based model unless the opposition to that concept, the teachers' unions, goes away. Because the teacher unions, they're not going to go for that. You're going to tell me that they're going to sit there while teachers are replaced by actors and CGI and computers. You really think the teachers unions are going to fucking let that happen? You are dumber than shit. So no, that's not happening. Colleges, same thing. If you transition college education to actors and CGI and doing it online, There's way too many people are going to lose. The college professors are going to lose. The colleges are going to lose their revenue from sports. Because if people aren't coming to the campus, if people are just doing things online, can you build up the same level of interest in your football program? And colleges that have football teams make a shit ton of money on football. Here in college, and I don't know the details on this because I have not attempted to look into it. So I'm gonna say some shit that I have heard like 17th hand. I don't know if it's true or not. I'm not saying it's true. I have heard that there is some kind of the Wuhan was in the CSU football team, but the football team tried to cover it up because they want to get back to playing football. And that might be true. That might be untrue. But the point is, again, it's believable because Colorado State University has this football stadium they just built like 3 years ago that cost a fucking fortune that they got to pay for. Colleges make a lot of money on football. And can you get people engaged in your spending money on your football team if they're not on the fucking campus? Okay, you got all these college professors that can't possibly get a fucking job in the real world. You got to support them. They may not have a union, but they still got power. And then, of course, we have the student loan industry, which, of course, has nothing at all to do with the banks. The banks are completely uninvolved in student loans, right? So let's not say anything about the banks. We can't blame the banks. No, nothing to do with banks. But there's all these people. They're not banks. None of them are banks. There's all these people who make money on student loans. Now, it's one thing you could get away with convincing people that they should pay $15,000 a semester to go to college on CSU campus. But are you going to be able to sell online courses for $15,000 a semester? I mean, maybe you will if the student loans are still there. Maybe people will still be dumb enough to pay that. But it's going to be a more difficult sale. And finally, the colleges are where the state completes their indoctrination of young people. It's where you teach women that all men are rapists. It's where you teach BIPOCs that all white people are racist. Right? So the state's not going to want to give up college experience. Student loan industry is not going to want to give up the college experience. The college professors and teachers aren't going to want to give up the college experience. The football teams and the people who make the money on the football teams and the football team revenue, they're not going to want to give up the college experience. All of that is working in opposition to the concept of moving learning onto the internet, which, to be clear, I am not opposed to moving learning onto the internet. That, I'm not opposed to the concept. I'm saying it's just not going to happen, right? It's like I am not opposed to the CSU women's volleyball team having sex with me, but I'm telling you it's not going to happen. So I don't say this because I don't want this to happen. I would love for Scott's prediction to come true because that would mean my prediction also came true. But it's not going to happen. Now, he finishes up with this. Probably the biggest obstacle to non-traditional learning is the value of the degree or certification one gets when done. If you have a degree from a top college, employers know approximately what they are getting. But if you have learned a variety of useful skills online, there is no degree program involved, how would anyone know your value? I expect this to change over time as credible business leaders and companies start endorsing certain collections of online classes as being degree equivalent. Now on that, I think he's going in the right direction. Because we do already see this like in the computer field, right? If you show up looking for a computer job, in some cases, I don't want to say in all, because this is, again, not something I've experienced firsthand, but those of you in the world of computers, you could tell me, right? Is it not true that in some cases, having your Cisco certification or your Microsoft certification or your Sun Technology certification, right? You got these certifications, and at least some employers don't give a flying shit if you went to college or some horse shit like that. They do you have this certification, and that's good enough for them. So in that, I could see that happening in some cases. I could see there being some employers that would accept some sort of completion of some series of online courses, just like a certification, and they would take that seriously and reward you for it with a job. All right, let's plow on because we're not going to get through all of this. His next section here is the end of unsolved crime. Have you noticed that nearly 100% of high-profile crimes seem to get solved? That's not an accident. In the United States and other developed countries, we have the technology to solve nearly any crime that merits enough resources. You are probably familiar with most of the crime-solving tools available to law enforcement, but when you see them listed together, it creates a powerful picture in which the rate of unsolved crime will approach zero. Unfortunately, it also creates a powerful picture of a world in which your freedom will approach zero. Here's what he talks about. Video everywhere. How there's video cameras everywhere. Yes, this is great for solving crime. It's also great for using against people to stifle their freedom. Your digital trail, if you own a smartphone, you know, people know where you've been. Yeah, it's great for solving crime. It's also great for stifling your freedom. DNA testing, which we know a lot of people have been convicted based on faulty DNA testing because DNA testing is not as accurate as you've been led to believe. But once again, DNA testing is a great thing. Yes, and DNA testing is also a wonderful way to reduce your freedom. So Scott optimistically sees it as the end of unsolved crimes, whereas I see it as the end of unsolved crimes plus greater restrictions upon your freedom and greater intrusions into your privacy, which Scott Adams doesn't care about because earlier in this book, he actually talks about how privacy is not always a good thing and you guys need to shut the fuck up about wanting privacy. I exaggerated that a little bit, but we'll get to that in another part of the series. Next, he talks about world peace. And he's got some good points here. Experts disagree on whether we are experiencing a trend of declining war in recent decades. Like most things, it depends on how you measure it. And comparisons of war dead over time are complicated by improvements in treating the wounded, not to mention, of course, population, also blah, blah, blah. But in my opinion, a number of forces are aligning to make wars far less likely in the future. Now here, I agree with him. Number one, mutually assured destruction keeps working. Number two, conquest is no longer economical. Number three, guerrilla resistors have access to better weaponry. Number four, economic war is a better substitute for physical war. He's completely right. Mutually assured destruction, we haven't nuked ourselves into oblivion yet. Fascinating how, even though those faggoty-ass scientists with their doomsday clock were 15 seconds away from midnight, oh, go fucking fuck yourself, you fucking pedophile faggot, right? This masturbation over how we're about to blow ourselves up with nuclear weapons. No, we're not. Shut up. Get over it. Now, were we close? I do think we were close in the, what do you call it, the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think things got a little hairy. Since then, we're fine. Really, just get over it, guys. Conquest is no longer economical. Let me skip ahead. Guerrilla resistors have access to better weaponry. I give you Afghanistan. Soviet Union and the United States both tried to conquer Afghanistan, both lost. Number two and number four, conquest is no longer economical, and economic war is a better substitute for physical war. Yes, and this is what I've been saying for ages. Let me do this quick because we're coming up on the end of the episode. Everybody, well, great one. In Encapadice, who's going to stop invaders? Okay, let's pretend the United States of America magically turns into Encapadice tomorrow. It doesn't matter how, right? There's no standing army. There's no federal government. Well, the Chinese would invade us. Why? The Chinese, to invade us, would have to move their army over here, the ammunition and supplies, and take over and fight the resistance and then set up administration. Why? To get what? To get, say, gold. Okay, it's cheaper and easier for the Chinese just to buy the fucking gold. It's cheaper and easier for the Chinese to just buy real estate. We are truly past this concept of invading other countries to get territory when you can just go over there and fucking buy stuff from them.